And good evening, I'm Melissa Idris. Welcome to Consider This. This is the show where we want you to consider and then reconsider what you know of the news of the day. I'm here today at the Malaysia Futures 2023 Forum, which is jointly organised by the LSE Sosu Hock Southeast Asia Centre and Khazanah Research Institute. This forum has brought together scholars and policymakers to discuss, anticipate and imagine all the possible futures of social, economic and political development. And one of the thought leaders that's in town for the conference today is Professor Shin Hyun Bang. He is a professor of geography and urban studies at the London School of Economics and Political Science and also director of the Sosu Hock Southeast Asia Centre. Professor Shin, thank you so much for being on the show with me. This forum,
Your pleasure is mine.
You know, you're one of the brains behind this forum. Now, I was curious if we could start our conversation there today. What was the thinking in bringing together these great minds to sit in a room? What are the types of discourses that you had hoped it would spark?
So we are trying to put together the themes that will be of great concern to the people who are in the country and also in the region. Trying to look at the dimensions of society, politics, economy, and the urban built environment to think of how we can bring together various perspectives to think of the multiple trajectories of future imaginaries that can be inclusive and equitable, acknowledging that there will be different views, especially expressed by policymakers, researchers, and businesses, and try to kind of bring them together to have a dialogue and conversation to identify what are the challenges that we can commonly agree to and how we can go about addressing those challenges, but not necessarily having to produce solutions during the last two days.
You're not solving the world's problems in a room in a day. Yeah. But one of the sessions that I thought was quite interesting was the one that you moderated on urban futures.
Thank you.
And your research focuses on urbanization and gentrification and the political economy of cities. So I was wondering if you could maybe lay it out for us where you think are the key challenges and some of the trends that you're observing when it comes to the process of urbanization, particularly when we talk about the context of Asian cities?
I guess there can be a few that stand out on the basis of my own research and my own observation on cities in Southeast Asia, as well as East Asia, as well as, broadly speaking, cities in Asia. So one challenge that seems to be quite evident is the growing disparity and inequality. Mm-hmm. Especially how the investment in real estate turns out to be very important ways of accumulating one's wealth. And this turns out to be also very important ways in which industries also tend to make profit. So you have all these real estate developers who are actually investing in cities to produce new housing estates. Mm-hmm. Which are largely aimed at those who have the resource to purchase. So upper middle classes in particular, who are the ones who actually have the means to purchase these new units, while the investment that goes into providing more affordable and social housing seems quite lacking. And I think that also reflects the growing trend in the market, which show the rapid price increase in commercial real estate units, which also creates this tendency of seeing a greater gaps between what one has as an income that can be used for the purchase of these units and what the real estate properties actually command as the selling price in the market. So I think that gap increasing over the years. The income is not increasing as much in the same way, and therefore more and more people are actually finding it difficult to become owners of these units or have a stable home to live in.
Okay, so based on your observations of that being one of the trends as a result of rapid urbanization, what are the possible policy interventions that you would suggest or that you've observed that has been adapted in other cities that might be able to reduce the impact of that inequality?
Well, I mean, it is not an easy issue. I mean, because there's a tendency among the government to make use of such investment in housing in this way to sustain the economic development. Mm-hmm. And it's an easy way to actually boost the economic growth. And therefore, governments often have the reluctance to stop or to curb such investment that goes into real estate development. Of course, the government also has the responsibility to look after people who are not able to sustain more affordable way of living and also have access to housing in an affordable way. So it will be probably important for the government to actually be showing more awareness of this need to support the population who doesn't have the means to have access to housing, and to be able to provide housing at an affordable price through various subsidies that go into the purchase, through the efforts to secure land. Mm-hmm. Which is located closer to the city center or in the city center as well, by means of using their own land asset as a way of identifying sites that can provide housing in a more affordable way for people to live closer or in the city center without being driven away from the center to the periphery. Mm. But that's what happens. Even if you see governments which provide housing that can be affordable to people, given the reluctance of identifying sites in the central areas, which is commanding much higher land value, these are more or less reserved for use by more resource-rich people, right, or developers. And therefore, the housing units which are for the poorer people tend to be far away from the city center.
And the periphery.
And they have
the
to commute long distance.
Right.
When long distance commute is being impeded by very, very poor public transport as well. So you have the problems of housing, public transport, infrastructure not really being brought together to support the living of the poor.
Are there any governments, based on your research, that have been able to do that, to provide housing in the city center?
Not in recent years.
Okay.
I mean, it's a challenge. I might have not answered the question directly previously, but for example, when you look at the government in South Korea. Since 1989, when South Korea for the first time introduced public housing, public rental housing for the poorest families, it slowly over the years expanded, and the stocks of affordable housing or social housing. But even then, South Korea, because of the way cities have evolved in Korea, the land available for such housing in more central location disappeared, and therefore, even though the government increased their investment in such housing for the poor people, these sites tend to be very far away from the city center. So we have, even though the number of units which fall into this category as housing for the poor has been increasing over the years, the locations turn out to be also very much not in favor of the people in Korea who are benefiting from such housing. In London, situation people often say in London, for example, where social housing were provided by local government, mm-hmm. Made a very important positive impact for the living of poor in London. Also, many of these units tend to be centrally located. But this is not the. This can be seen as a historical outcome of urban development. What I mean is these units were provided in those areas which came out to be more central nowadays, and also because many were London being having seen the bombing during the war,
right,
and therefore many areas which were bombed were also being used for various other purposes, including the building of social public housing for people who are in need of shelters at the time during the post-war construction, and they turned out to be very much central location at the time. But as London became more prosperous, and these locations also turned out to be very important, were very expensive, and many of these units are nowadays also being, they are going through a disappearance, and they are turned into other types of development that cannot be afforded by poorer people nowadays. And therefore, London itself, even though it was known to be having housing in central location for the poor, is also going through a very rapid process of gentrification. Right. Which basically drives people away from central locations to the periphery.
Professor, I have to ask you a basic question.
Sure.
What are the consequences of having a city centre that is concentrated with the higher income class and having the lower income class in the periphery of the centre? What are the consequences of that?
The consequences? That's will be the outcome of continuous gentrification,
right,
where you get to see the concentration. It can be in a concentration of certain areas by higher income people while driving poorer people away from the areas. It can be different, several pockets. It's not like necessarily the entire central part of city occupied by higher income people, because that wouldn't happen.
So pockets.
It's a pocket, and the pockets will tend to be emerging here and there. And sometimes the pockets may join to produce larger sect, larger district that can be seen as exclusively for higher income people. So the consequence will be, I guess,
social or economic consequences. I'm thinking in my head. It changes the social fabric of a city, right?
I think this is where the social inequality comes in again. What I was starting with, the greater inequality being produced because of such imbalanced sharing of the resource and the wealth in the society, increasingly contributing to this growing conflict between the poorer people and the richer people. Because you can clearly see with your own eyes the different types of living, different conditions of living higher income people may experience versus the living that poorer people may have access to in terms of accessing urban services,
right,
accessing amenities, and having access to more sanitized urban space versus other urban spaces where such high-quality urban services are not being provided. Yeah. And therefore, you have an impact on your health outcome, your educational outcome for your children, your outcome, the impact on your on the aging population. And all these are having not just the immediate impact, but it has a longer-term impact as well, because that inequity being produced will be having a profound impact on different dimensions of living.
I like that, we all have a right to the city, right? We have the right to an equal, inclusive city, and to participate in urban life. How can you explain that to us in terms of the way policy should be shaped by our right to the city as dwellers of the city?
So you can think of it in two ways. One is, very often when it comes to making decisions on where a new development will take place, and the new development may include not just higher end in a commercial housing estate. It can also be infrastructure, new public transport, or new hospital, new schools. Whenever these decisions are being made, very often these are made by let's say more political and economic elite, or people who have the access to such decision-making process. So real estate developers will be able to make such a decision based on what they calculate as the most profiteering ways, and negotiate with local planners, government officials, and try to use their own power to influence this process so that they can get the land that they require and build the property in the way that they imagine. Government planners, policymakers will also have their own ways of thinking about where to put in a sort of new development in which areas. It can be in response to the demand from their own constituency. It can be in response to some lobbying. But they do have that kind of in a decision-making power.
Okay.
They will result in new development. Whereas local communities or other small businesses who don't really have access to such a process will not be able to influence that process, right?
But we want them to have access, so that we want participatory urban governance. How do we ensure that there is access from a diverse community, not just a certain group or elites or in the ruling class, for instance?
Again, two things probably you can think of. One is more greater transparency in terms of how these are being decided and what projects are being proposed. So when a new project is being proposed, you need to actually have an understanding in advance, with a good time for people to start thinking about and mobilize themselves and express their views and also intervene in the process, without being given the information like a few days before or in a way that doesn't get noticed, right? And that happens quite a lot everywhere.
It does. It happens here.
You just have a piece of paper on the wall and says, like, this is a public announcement. If you have any objection, you reply by a certain date, but you don't have many days to respond, but also you don't get to see the notice in a visible way.
Well, sometimes it's kind of a checklist, right?
In a sense, yes.
Let's have public engagement, and it's just a poster on the wall.
That's right. That's one thing that needs to be really improved.
Okay.
The second thing is, and this is what I was trying to say towards the end of yesterday's session, where people really need to be politicized. And to be taken in a more positive way, because being political is what characterizes our everyday life. Because at individual and family level, which people do not associate with politics, we actually make a decision in terms of use of the resource, use of our time, the use of resource within the family, who's going to get what share of the family resource, and so on. All these are going to involve negotiations. So there's always the kind of intra-family politics that are being played out.
Yeah.
Within community, there's also in a community level in a discussion, negotiation taking place. And there's people who talk about political issues without realizing these are very much the issue of political exercise of one's power and decision making. Indeed.
Politics,
but we also try to kind of reserve such decision when it comes to these new development, use of governmental budget, and so on, to be the domain of politicians and policymakers, not the domain of everyday the grassroots people. So we really need to kind of with a bit of a longer term perspective, organize the power to be to mobilize to become more political and to receive the act of being political to be something positive, something that we do on an everyday basis, without thinking of this as to be something radical or resistant and so on.
Right. Professor, have you had a chance to survey the Malaysian landscape, the Malaysian urban landscape? I'm wondering, are there things that, what would you say are needed for the cities here in Malaysia?
I wouldn't claim myself to be an expert on this, and I admit I haven't been to Malaysia that many times to be able to say something. With only my limited experience, the one thing I can perhaps say is connectivity to be more improved, especially public transport, and the spatial planning, especially when it comes to thinking about the relationship between the living space, the business space, and commercial space. How these needs to be connected much better in order for people to move around from point A to point B. So here, for example, from Bangsa South, if I want to go to city center, I have to actually walk like 1.1 kilometers from the hotel to the nearest LRT station. And under the heat of Malaysia, it's not an easy thing to do. Or maybe people in Malaysia may be used to the heat, and so they may commit to this.
No, we're definitely not.
Well, if that's the case, even ascertains my point. That kind of inconvenience does drive people away from using public transport, while public transport has to be expanded and receive more support. And therefore, people moving to private cars or commercial taxis and so on, without actually experiencing the city using public transport or on their foot. And that actually decreases the connectivity, and that happens a lot between different destinations. And I think that probably needs to receive more proactive support from the government realizing this is really important, and the resource the government may command will have to be prioritized to put into enhancing the infrastructure provision for people to have greater connectivity to different parts of the city. And only then people will start care more about different parts of the city rather than being isolated or confined to area that they have, you know, access to.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, when you talked about the heat, it really got me thinking. The other aspect about city planning or looking at urban living is that we have to respond to the climate crisis. Mm. So there are, in fact, many challenges that cities have to respond to, not just the climate crisis, but, you know, we've been through a pandemic, there are natural disasters, there's a heat wave, sometimes there's floods. Some of these crises are also man-made or man-created. Mm-hmm. How can cities increase their urban resilience, particularly when it comes to the climate crisis? Are we doing enough to make sure that cities are resilient to anything that may come in our way in the future?
I would probably say we don't do enough, definitely. As some of the panel members yesterday were speaking about, you know, we need, you know, at least we need to have more, you know, data that would give us clearer ideas of how things are affecting us in what way and where, and that, you know, data to be accumulated over time so that we have a clearer picture over a longer period of time so that, you know, a more informed decision can be made.
Okay.
We always talk about, even in academia, we emphasize the need of evidence-based policy.
Right.
And that expression has been going around for many years, but we still have lack of evidence.
But is there enough urgency? I mean, if we're waiting for data, it might be too late by the time, you know, city. So urban planning, city living is all, you know, happens decades in advance, and the consequences are much further down the road. Is it too late if we're dealing with something as urgent as a climate crisis?
We need to act now. I mean, yes, it may be already late, but we still have to do something about this. and make actions. So having clear and, you know, more transparent data that can, you know, provide evidence for policy making, that can be one thing. Second thing is to, you know, acknowledge, you know, at all levels, you know, and at the grassroots level, at police, at the governmental level, to acknowledge the fact that, you know, these climate change consequences will have a very uneven impact on people.
Mm.
We often see this kind of, you know, sci-fi kind of movies where you see kind of in the rich and powerful actually live in a very isolated and protected space, while the rest of the country or the cities are submerged underwater and so on, or
high up
in the satellite, right? So you have these kind of sci-fi movies which actually turn out to be more likely to be happening in the near future, where. And this actually shows, you know, and many examples of, you know, recent, you know, disaster episodes actually tell us that the impact of such disasters, including climate change-related, you know, disasters, do have very uneven impact. Mm. And this largely is, you know, reflecting the uneven the spatial structure, inequity already built in the urban fabric. And therefore, many of these are actually exposing people who are already in disaster-prone areas and living in those areas to be more vulnerable to such disasters forthcoming. And therefore, I think this is where we just need to acknowledge that, you know, this is the reality of our cities, and to be open to these realities and make sure that, you know, policies are reflecting such conditions from the outset. And the leaders also acknowledging this is the cities that we have inherited, and we have to start with this, and acknowledgement, and thinking of how to, you know, ameliorate the situations with a longer term goal to basically make more preventive actions, you know, and how these, you know, understandings can be reflected in future design of cities and future investment the government will be undertaking.
I mean, just based on your observations, are you seeing people being more receptive to the need to create resilience in our cities? Is this something that we, the public, are concerned about?
Again, this is where I would probably start by saying yes and no. I mean, so more recently, together with some colleagues in Thailand, in Chulalongkorn University, and colleagues in the UK, we are doing a project in Thailand on the issue of flooding risk and community resilience.
Mm-hmm.
In our interviews with the local villagers, you know, the word climate change didn't come out.
Oh.
People were referring to the ongoing urbanization that was producing new housing estates that were built on concrete foundation, yeah. New factories that were built on elevated concrete foundation, all elevated and protected by concrete to avoid flooding risk, which actually created remaining villages as being situated in low-lying areas, which are more prone to the waters piling up, you know, when heavy rainfall happens. So people are seeing these urbanization and industrialization processes as to be more the regions for flooding, greater chance of flooding experience that they were going through, without linking it to climate change-related discourses. So in a sense, I mean, there needs to be more awareness and a greater way of discussing this so that people can start realizing there's a connection between the two. But referring everything to climate change can also have a negative consequence because, as I was saying, new housing construction, new factory construction in a way that actually renders people to be more vulnerable to the emerging risk of flooding. Also, it's a human, the consequence of human actions, regardless of climate change, right? So you need to have attention to both dimensions and have make sure that people understand how these are, despite they appear to be seemingly separate processes, they're actually connected to produce this more severe consequence on people. And so you need to actually have actions to address both types of processes.
Definitely. Professor, thank you so much for speaking.
Pleasure.
Appreciate your time. That wraps up this episode of Consider This. I'm Melissa Idris, signing off for the evening. Thank you so much for watching and good night.